He slipped the dagger under his robes. "And I will pray to God for you, knight," she said. She leaned over to kiss his cheek chastely. As she did, she whispered, "Your escort is Raimondo of Narbonne. He likes to cut throats. When he knows the secret, have a care he does not cut yours and those of your friends as well." She stepped away, smiling. Merrick said, "Lady, you are too kind. I shall take your kind wishes to heart." "Good night. God speed you safe and true." "Lady, you are always in my thoughts." "Good, Sir Knight. I would wish..."
"Enough! Enough!"
Arno said in a disgusted voice. He turned to Raimondo.
"Go now, Raimondo, for this surfeit of sentiment makes my stomach heave."
"My lord." The handsome knight bowed. He led Merrick to the door and out into the sunlight. 7 hours, 34 minutes, 49 seconds.
"I'll tell you what the goddamn problem is,"
Robert Doniger said, glaring at the visitors. "The problem is to bring the past alive, to make it real." There were two young men and the young woman, all slouching on the couch in his office. They were dressed entirely in black, wearing those pint shoulder jackets that looked like they'd shrunk in the wash. The men had long hair, and the woman had a buzz cut. These were the media people that Kramer had hired, but Doniger noticed that today Kramer was sitting opposite them, subtly divorcing herself from them. He wondered if she had already seen their material. It made Doniger irritable. He didn't like media people anyway, and this was his second meeting with the breed today. He'd had the PR dipshits in the morning, now these dipshits. "The problem," he said, "is that I have 30 executives coming to hear my presentation tomorrow. The title of my presentation is The Promise of the Past, and I have no compelling visuals to show them."
"Got it," one of the young men said crisply. "That was exactly our starting point here, Mr. Doniger. The client wants to bring the past alive. That's what we set out to do. With Ms. Kramer's help, we asked your own observers to generate sample videos for us, and we believe this material will have the compelling quality..."
"Let's see it," Doniger said.
"Yes, sir. Perhaps if we lower the lights..."
"Leave the lights as they are."
"Yes, Mr. Doniger."
The video screen on the wall came up blue as it glowed to life. While they were waiting for the image, the young man said,
"The reason we like this first one is because it is a famous historical event that lasts only 2 minutes from start to finish. As you know, many historical events occurred very slowly, especially to modern sensibilities. This one was quick. Unfortunately, it occurred on a somewhat rainy day."
The screen showed a gray, gloomy image overhanging clouds. The camera panned over to show some sort of gathering, shot over the heads of a large crowd. A tall man was climbing up into a plain, unpainted wood platform.
"What's this, a hanging?"
"No," the media kid said. "That's Abraham Lincoln about to deliver the Gettysburg Address."
"It is? Jesus, he looks like hell. He looks like a corpse. His clothes are all wrinkled. His arms stick out of his sleeves."
"Yes, sir, but..."
"And is that his voice? It's squeaky."
"Yes, Mr. Doniger. No one's ever heard Lincoln's voice before, but that is his actual..."
"Are you out of your fucking minds?"
"No, Mr. Doniger. Oh, for Christ's sake, I can't use this," Doniger said. "No one wants Abraham Lincoln to sound like Betty Boop. What else have you got?" "It's right here, Mr. Doniger."
Unruffled, the man changed the tape, saying, "For the second video, we adopted a different premise. We wanted a good action sequence, but again, a famous event that everybody would know. So this is Christmas Day, 1778, on the Delaware River, where..."
"I can't see shit," Doniger said.
"Yes, I'm afraid it is a bit dark. It's a night crossing. But we thought George Washington crossing the Delaware would be a good..."
"George Washington? Where is George Washington?"
"He's right there," the kid said, pointing to the screen.
"Where?"
"There.
He's that guy huddled in the back of the boat?"
"That's correct, and..."
"No, no, no," Doniger said. "He has to be standing in the bow, like a general."
"I know that's the way the paintings portray him, but it's not what actually happened. Here you see the real George Washington as he actually crossed the..."
"He looks seasick," Doniger said. "You want me to show a video of George Washington looking seasick?
But this is reality."
"Fuck reality," Doniger said, throwing one of their videotapes across the room. What's the matter with you people? I don't care about reality. I want something intriguing, something sexy. You're showing me a walking corpse and a drowned rat.
Well, we can go back to the drawing board.
My talk is tomorrow, Doniger said. I have 3 major executives coming here, and I have already told them they would see something very special. He threw up his hands.
Jesus Christ!
Kramer cleared her throat. What about using stills?
Stills?
Yes, Bob. You could take single frames from these videos, and that might be quite effective, Kramer said.
Uh-huh, yes, that would work, the media people all said, heads bobbing.
Doniger said, Lincoln would still look wrinkled.
We'll take the wrinkles out with Photoshop.
Doniger considered that.
Maybe,
he said finally.
Anyway, Kramer said, you don't want to show them too much. Less is more.
All right, Doniger said. Make the stills up and show them to me in an hour.
The media people filed out. Doniger was alone with Kramer. He went behind his desk, shuffled through his presentation. Then he said,
Do you think it should be the promise of the past or the future of the past?
The promise of the past, Kramer said. Definitely the promise.
7 hours, 34 minutes, 49 seconds. Accompanied by 2 knights, Merrick rode in the dust of the baggage carts, moving toward the head of the column. He could not see Chris or Kate yet, but his little group was moving swiftly. He would catch up to them soon. He looked at the knights on either side of him, Raimondo on his left, erect in full armor with his thin smile. On his right, a grizzled warrior in armor, clearly tough and competent. Neither man paid him much attention, so secure were they in their control over him, especially since his hands were bound together by ropes with a 6-inch gap between the wrists. He rode along, coughing in the dust. Eventually, he managed to slip his small dagger from beneath his coat and palm it beneath his hand as he gripped the wooden pommel of the saddle in front of him. He tried to position the knife so the gentle movement of the horse up and down would slowly fray the rope at his wrists. But this was easier said than done. The knife seemed to be always in the wrong position, and his bonds were not cut. Merrick glanced at his wristband counter.
It read 7 hours, 21 minutes, 2 seconds. There were still more than 7 hours left before the batteries ran out.
Soon they had left the riverside trail behind and started to climb the twisting road up through the village of La Roque. The village was built into the cliffs above the river, the houses almost entirely of stone, giving the town a unified, somber appearance, especially now when every door and window was boarded shut in anticipation of war. Now they moved among the lead companies of Arnaud's soldiers, more knights in armor, each with their retinues following. Men and horses climbed the steep, cobbled streets, horses snorting, baggage carts slipping as they went up. These knights in the lead had a sense of urgency. Many of the carts carried pieces of disassembled siege engines. Evidently, they planned to begin the siege before nightfall. They were still within the town when Merrick caught sight of Chris and Kate, riding side by side on sagging mounts. They were perhaps 100 yards ahead of them, alternately visible and hidden as the road twisted up. Raimondo put his hand on Merrick's arm. We approach no closer. In the dust ahead, a banner flapped too near a horse's face. The horse reared, whinnying. A cart turned over, spilling cannonballs, which began to roll down the hill. This was the moment of confusion Merrick had been waiting for, and he acted on it. He spurred his horse, which refused to go. Then he saw the grizzled knight had deftly grabbed the reins. My friend, Raimondo said calmly, riding beside him, do not make me kill you, at least not yet. He nodded to Merrick's hands, and put that foolish little blade away before you hurt yourself. Merrick felt his cheeks burn, but he did as he was told. He put the small dagger back beneath his robes. They rode on in silence. From behind the stone houses, they heard the cry of a bird, repeated twice. Raimondo's head snapped around when he heard it. So did his companion on the other side. Evidently, it was not a bird. The men listened, and soon there was an answering cry from further up the hill. Raimondo rested his hand on his sword, but did nothing else. What is it? Merrick said. No wise your affair. And they said nothing else. The soldiers were busy and no one paid them any attention, especially since their saddles had Arnaud's colors of green and black. Eventually they arrived at the top of the cliff and came out into an open field with the castle on their right. The forest was close by on their left, and the broad, sloping, grassy plain was to the north. With Arnaud's soldiers all around them, Merrick did not particularly think about the fact that they were passing some 50 yards from the outer moat and the gatehouses of the castle entrance. Chris and Kate were still about 100 yards ahead up the column. The attack came with stunning swiftness. 5 mounted knights charged from the woods to their left, shouting battle cries and swinging their swords over their heads. They ran right for Merrick and the others. It was an ambush. With a howl, Raimondo and the grizzled knight drew their swords to fight. The horses wheeled, blades clanged. Arnaud himself galloped up and joined the fray, fighting furiously. Merrick was momentarily ignored. Looking up the column, he saw that another group had attacked Kate and Chris. Merrick glimpsed the black plume of Sir Guy, and then the horsemen had surrounded the two. Merrick spurred his mount and began galloping up the line. Ahead, he saw one of the knights grab Chris by his coat and try to pull him from his horse. Another grabbed the reins of Kate's horse, which whinnied and turned. Another knight had taken Chris's reins, but he kicked his horse so that it reared. The knight let go, but Chris was suddenly covered in blood, and he cried out in shock. Chris lost control of his horse, which whinnied and galloped away into the woods, while he slid sideways in the saddle, hanging on weakly. In a moment, he had vanished among the trees. Kate was still trying to pull her reins free from the knight who held them. All around there was pandemonium. Arnaud's men shouting and circling, running for their weapons, jabbing at the attacking knights with their pikes. One stabbed at the knight holding her horse, and the knight dropped the reins. Merrick, though unarmed, charged into the middle of the fight, separating Kate from her attacker. She cried, "Andre!" But he said to her, "Go, go!" And then Merrick cried, "Malagon!" And Sir Guy turned to face him. Merrick immediately rode his horse away from the fray, galloping directly toward La Roque. The other knights wheeled and broke free of the soldiers, thundering across the open field after Merrick. Down the line, Merrick saw Raimondo and Arnaud fighting in a great cloud of dust. Kate kicked her horse, spurring him toward the woods to the north. Looking behind her as she rode, she saw Merrick ride over the drawbridge of La Roque, into the castle and out of sight. The pursuing riders followed him. Then the heavy grill of the portcullis gate came rumbling down, and the drawbridge raised up. Merrick was gone. Chris was gone. Either or both of them might be dead. But one thing was clear. She was the only one still free. It was up to her now.
7 hours, 24 minutes, 33 seconds. Surrounded on all sides by soldiers, she spent the next half an hour threading her way through Arnaud's baggage train of horses and carts, trying to reach the northern woods. Arnaud's men were setting up a vast, tented camp at the edge of the woods, facing the great grassy plain that sloped up to the castle. Men shouted to her to come and help them, but she could only wave in what she hoped was a manly greeting and keep moving. At length she reached the edge of the forest and followed it until she saw the narrow trail leading into darkness and isolation. Here she paused a few moments to let the horse rest and to let her own pounding heart slow down before she went into the woods. Back on the plain, the trebuchets were being swiftly assembled by groups of engineers. The trebuchets looked ungainly, oversized slingshots with heavy wooden beams bracing the armature for the firing paddle, which was winched back by stout hemp ropes, then released to snap upward, flinging its payload over the castle walls. The entire contraption appeared to weigh 500 pounds, but the men constructed it swiftly, working in quick coordination, then going on to the next engine. But at least she understood now how, in some instances, a church or a castle could be built in a couple of years. The workers were so skilled, so self-effacing, they hardly needed direction. She turned the horse away and entered the dense woods north of the castle. The path was a narrow track through the forest, which rapidly grew dark as she went deeper. It felt spooky to be alone here. She heard the hooting of owls and the distant cries of strange birds.
She passed one tree with a dozen ravens sitting on branches.
She counted them, wondering if it was an omen and what it portended.
Riding slowly through the forest, she had the sense of slipping backward in time, of taking on more primitive ways of thought.
The trees closed over her. The ground was as dark as evening. She had a sense of confinement, of oppression. After 20 minutes, she was relieved to come into a clearing with tall grass in sunlight. She saw a break in the trees on the far side where the path resumed. She was riding through the clearing when she saw a castle off to her left. She didn't remember any sort of structure from her charts, but it was here nevertheless. The castle was small, almost a manor house, and whitewashed so that it shone brightly in the sun. It had 4 small turrets and a blue slate roof. At first glance, it looked cheerful, but then she noticed all the windows were barred. Part of the slate roof had fallen in, leaving a ragged hole. The outbuildings were crumbling and in disrepair. This clearing had once been a mown field in front of the castle, now grown wild from neglect. She had a strong sense of stagnation and decay. She shivered and spurred the horse on. She noticed that the grass ahead had recently been trampled down by the footprints of another horse, moving in the same direction as she. As she looked, she saw the long blades of grass slowly rising upward, returning to their original position. Someone had been here very recently, perhaps only a few minutes before. Cautiously, she proceeded toward the far end of the clearing. Darkness closed around her again as she slipped back into the forest. The trail ahead was becoming muddy, and she could see distinct hoofprints going forward. From time to time, she paused and listened intently, but she heard nothing at all up ahead. Either the rider was far in front of her, or he was very quiet. Once or twice she thought she heard the sound of a horse, but she couldn't be sure. It was probably her imagination. She pushed on toward the Green Chapel, to what had been called, on her maps, La Chapelle Verte Morte, the Chapel of Green Death. In the darkness of the forest, she came upon a figure leaning wearily against a fallen tree. He was a wizened old man, wearing a hood and carrying a woodsman's axe. As she rode by, he said,
"I beg you, good master, I beg you."
His voice was thin, rasping.
"Give me some small thing to eat, for I am poor and have no food."
Kate did not think she had any food, but then she remembered the knight had given them a small bundle tied behind her saddle. She reached back, found a crust of bread and a piece of dried beef. It didn't look appetizing, particularly since it now smelled strongly of horse sweat. She held the food out to him. Eagerly, the man came forward, reached a bony hand for the food. But instead, he grabbed her outstretched arm at the wrist with a surprisingly strong grip, and with a swift yank, tried to pull her from the horse. He cackled with delight, a nasty sound. As he struggled with her, his hood fell back, and she saw that he was younger than she had thought. Now 3 other men ran forward from the shadows on both sides of the path, and she realized that they were Gaudin, the peasant bandits. Kate was still in the saddle, but clearly not for long. She kicked the horse, but it was tired and unresponsive. The older man continued tugging at her arm, all the while muttering, "Foolish boy, you silly boy." Not knowing what else to do, she screamed for help, screaming at the top of her lungs, and this seemed to startle the men, so that they paused for a moment before resuming their attack. But then they heard the sound of a galloping horse coming toward them, and the roar of a warrior's battle cry, and the Gaudin looked at one another and scattered, all except the wizened man, who refused to release Kate, and now threatened her with his axe, which he raised in his other hand. But in that moment, an apparition, a blood-red knight on horseback, came crashing down the trail, his horse snorting, flinging clops of mud, the knight himself so fierce and bloody that the last man ran for his life, plunging into the darkness of the forest. Chris reined up and circled around her. She felt a huge wave of relief flood through her. She had been badly frightened. Chris was smiling, clearly pleased with himself. "Are you all right, ma'am?" he said. "Are you?" Kate asked, amazed. Chris was literally drenched in blood. It had dried all over his face and body, and when he smiled, it cracked at the sides of his mouth, revealing the pink skin beneath. He looked as if he had fallen in a vat of red. "I'm fine," Chris said. "Somebody hacked the horse next to me, cut an artery or something. I was soaked in blood. Blood is hot. Did you know that?" Kate was still staring at him, amazed to see anyone who looked like that making jokes. and then he took her horse's reins and led her quickly away. "I think," Chris said, "we won't wait for them to regroup. Didn't your mother tell you not to talk to strangers, Kate? Especially when you meet them in the woods."
"Actually, I thought you were supposed to give them food, and they helped you."
"Only in fairy tales," he said. "In the real world, if you stop to help the poor man in the woods, he and his friends steal your horse and kill you. That's why nobody does it." Chris was still grinning, and he seemed so confident and amused, and she had the feeling that she had never noticed, never been aware, that he was quite an attractive man, that he had a certain genuine appeal. But of course, she thought, he had saved her life. She was just grateful.
"What were you doing anyway?" she said.
He laughed. "Trying to catch up to you. I thought you were way ahead of me." The path divided. The main path appeared to go off to the right, beginning a slow downward descent. A much narrower track went to the left on flat ground, but it seemed much less used.
"What do you think?" Kate said.
"Take the main road," Chris said. He led the way forward, and Kate was quite happy to follow him. The forest around them grew more lush, the ground ferns 6 feet high, like huge elephant ears, obscuring her view ahead. She heard a distant roar of water. The land began to slope downward more sharply, and she couldn't see her footing because of the ferns. They both dismounted and tied their horses loosely to a tree. They proceeded on foot. The land sloped steeply downward now, and the path turned into a muddy track. Chris slipped, grasping at branches and shrubs to break his slide. She watched as he slipped and slid, and then with a yell, he was gone. She waited.
"Chris?"
No answer. She tapped her earpiece.
"Chris?"
Nothing. She was not sure what to do, whether to go forward or retrace her steps backward. She decided to follow him, but cautiously, now that she knew how slippery the path was and what had happened to him. Yet after only a few careful steps, her feet shot out from beneath her, and she was sliding helplessly in the mud, banged against tree trunks, knocking the wind out of her. The terrain grew steeper. Kate fell backward in the mud and slid down on her backside, trying to use her feet to push off tree trunks as they rushed up. Branches scratched her face, tore at her hands as she reached for them. She didn't seem to be able to stop her headlong rush down. And all the time, the terrain grew steeper. Now the trees ahead were thinning. She could see light between the trunks, and she heard the rush of water. She was sliding down a path that ran parallel to a small stream. The trees thinned more, and she saw that the forest ended abruptly about 20 yards ahead. The rushing sound of water grew louder, and then she realized why the forest ended. It was the edge of a cliff, and beyond was a waterfall, directly ahead. Terrified, Kate rolled over on her stomach, dug her fingers like claws into the mud, but to no avail. She still continued to slide. She couldn't stop. She rolled onto her back, still sliding down a chute of mud, helpless to do anything but watch the end coming. And then she shot out of the forest and was flying in the air, hardly daring to look down. Almost immediately, she smashed down into foliage, clutched at it, and held. She swung up and down. She was in the branches of a large tree, hanging out over the cliff. The waterfall was directly below her. It wasn't as large as she had thought, maybe 10-15 feet. There was a pool at the base. She couldn't tell how deep it was. She tried to climb back along the branches of the tree, but her hands were slippery from the mud. She kept slipping, twisting on the branch. Eventually, she was hanging beneath, clutching it with hands and legs like a sloth as she tried to work her way backward. She went another 5 feet, then realized she would never make it. She fell. She struck another branch 4 feet lower. She hung there a moment, gripping the branch with slippery, muddy hands. Then she fell again, struck a lower branch. Now she was just a few feet above the waterfall as it curved, roaring, over the lip of the cliff. The branches of the tree were wet from mist. She looked at the churning pool of water at the base. She couldn't see the bottom. She couldn't be sure how deep it was. Hanging precariously from the branch, she thought, "Where the hell is Chris?" But in the next moment, she lost her grip and fell the rest of the way. The water was an icy shock, bubbling, opaque, roiling furiously around her. She tumbled, disoriented, kicked to the surface, banged against rocks on the bottom. Finally, she came up beneath the waterfall, which pounded on her head with incredible force. She couldn't breathe. She ducked down again, swam ahead, and came out a few yards downstream. The water in the pool was calmer, though still chillingly cold. She climbed out and sat on a rock. She saw that the churning water had washed all the mud from her clothes, from her body. She felt somehow new and very glad to be alive. Catching her breath, she looked around. She was in a narrow little vale, the afternoon light misty from the waterfall. The valley was lush and wet, the grass was wet, the trees and rocks covered in moss. Directly ahead, a stone path led to a small chapel. The chapel was wet, too. Its surface is covered with a kind of slimy mold, which streaked the walls and dripped from the edge of the roof. The mold was bright green. The Green Chapel. She also saw broken suits of armor heaped untidily beside the chapel door, old breastplates rusting in the pale sun, and dented helmets lying on their sides, also swords and axes casually thrown all around. Kate looked for Chris, but didn't see him. Evidently, he hadn't fallen all the way, as she had. Probably he was making his way down by another path. She thought she would wait for him. She had been happy to see him earlier and missed him now. But she didn't see Chris anywhere, and aside from the waterfall, she heard no sound at all in the little valley, not even birds.
It was ominously silent.
And yet she did not feel alone. She had the strong sense of something else here, a presence in the valley. And then she heard a growling sound from inside the chapel, a guttural, animal sound. She stood and moved cautiously along the stone path toward the weapons. She picked up a sword and gripped the handle in both hands, even though she felt foolish. The sword was heavy, and she knew she had neither the strength nor the skill to use it. She was now close to the chapel door, and she smelled a strong odor of decay from inside. The growling came again. And suddenly, an armored knight stepped forward, blocking the doorway. He was a huge man, nearly 7 feet tall, and his armor was smeared with green mold. He wore a heavy helmet, so she could not see his face. He carried a heavy double-bladed axe like an executioner's axe. The axe swung back and forth as the knight advanced toward her. Instinctively, she backed away, her eyes on the axe. Her first thought was to run, but the knight had jumped out at her quickly. She suspected he might be able to catch her. Anyway, she didn't want to turn her back on him, but she couldn't attack. He seemed to be twice her size. He never spoke. She heard only grunting and snarling from inside the helmet. Animal sounds, demented sounds. He must be insane, she thought. The knight came quickly closer, forcing her to act. She swung her sword with all her strength. He raised his axe to block, and metal clanged against metal. Her sword vibrated so strongly she nearly lost her grip. She swung again, low, trying to cut his legs, but he easily blocked again, and with a quick twist of his axe, the blade flew from her hands, landing on the grass beyond. She turned and ran. Snarling, the knight raced forward and grabbed a fistful of her short hair. He dragged her screaming around to the side of the chapel. Her scalp burned. Ahead, she saw a carved block of wood on the ground, showing the marks of many deep cuts. She knew what it was, a beheading block. She was powerless to oppose him. The knight pushed her down roughly, forcing her neck onto the block. He stood with his foot in the middle of her back to hold her in position. She flailed her arms helplessly. She saw a shadow move across the grass as he raised his axe into the air. 6 hours, 40 minutes, 27 seconds. The telephone rang insistently, loudly. David Stern yawned, flicked on the bedside lamp, picked up the receiver. "Hello," he said, his voice groggy.
"David, it's John Gordon. You'd better come down to the transit room."
Stern fumbled for his glasses, looked at his watch. It was 6:05 a.m. He had slept for 3 hours.
"There's a decision to make," Gordon said. "I'll be up to get you in 5 minutes."
Okay, Stern said and hung up. He got out of bed and opened the blinds at the window. Bright sunlight shone in, so bright that it made him squint. He headed for the bathroom to take a shower. He was in one of the three rooms that ITC maintained in their laboratory building for researchers who had to work through the night. It was equipped like a hotel room, even down to the little bottles of shampoo and moisturizing cream by the sink. Stern shaved and dressed, then stepped out into the hallway. He didn't see Gordon anywhere, but he heard voices from the far end of the corridor. He walked down the hall, looking through the glass doors into the various labs. They were all deserted at this hour. But at the end of the corridor, he found a lab with its door open. A workman with yellow tape was measuring the height and width of the doorway. Inside, four technicians were all standing around a large table looking down at it. On the table was a large-scale model built of pale wood, showing the fortress of Laroque and the surrounding area. The men were murmuring to one another, and one was tentatively lifting the edge of the table. It seemed they were trying to figure out how to move it. "Doniger says he has to have it," the technician said, "as an exhibit after the presentation." "I don't see how we get it out of the room," another said. "How'd they get it in?" "They built it in place." "It'll just make it," said the man at the door, snapping his tape measure shut. Curious, Stern walked into the room, looked more closely at the model. It showed the castle recognizable and accurate in the center of a much larger complex. Beyond the castle was a ring of foliage, and outside that a complex of blocky buildings and a network of roads. Yet none of that existed. In medieval times, the castle had stood alone on a plain. Stern said, "What model is this?"
"Laroque," a technician said.
"But this model isn't accurate."
"Oh, yes," the technician said. "It's entirely accurate, at least according to the latest architectural drawings they've given us."
"What architectural drawings?" Stern said.
At that, the technicians fell silent, worried looks on their faces. Now Stern saw there were other scale models, of Castelgar and of the monastery of Saint-Mère. He saw large drawings on the walls. It was like an architect's office, he thought. At that moment, Gordon stuck his head in the door.
"David, let's go."
He walked down the corridor with Gordon. Looking over his shoulder, he saw the technicians had turned the model on end and were carrying it through the door.
"What's that all about?" Stern said.
"Site development study," Gordon said. "We do them for every project site. The idea is to define the immediate environment around the historical monument so that the site itself is preserved for tourists and scholars. They study view lines, things like that."
"But why is that any of your business?" Stern said.
"It's absolutely our business," Gordon said. "We're going to spend millions before a site is fully restored, and we don't want it junked up with a shopping mall and a bunch of high-rise hotels. So we try to do a larger site planning, see if we can get the local government to set guidelines."
He looked at Stern.
"Frankly, I never thought it was particularly interesting."
"And what about the transit room? What's going on there?"
"I'll show you."
The rubber floor of the transit site had been cleared of debris and cleaned. In the places where acid had eaten through the rubber, the flooring was being replaced by workmen on their hands and knees. Two of the glass shields were in place, and one was being inspected closely by a man wearing thick goggles and carrying an odd hooded light. But Stern was looking upward as the next big glass panels were swung in on overhead cranes from the second transit site, still being built.
"It's lucky we had that other transit site under construction," Gordon said to him. "Otherwise, it'd take us a week to get these glass panels down here. But panels were already here. All we have to do is move them over. Very lucky."
Stern still stared upward. He hadn't realized how large the shielding panels were. Suspended above him, the curved glass panels were easily 10 feet high and 15 feet wide and almost 2 feet deep. They were carried in padded slings towards special mounting brackets in the floor below.
"But," Gordon said, "we have no spares. We just have one full set."
"So?" Gordon walked over to one of the glass panels already standing in place.
"Basically, you can think of these things as big glass hip flasks," Gordon said. "They're curved containers that fill from a hole at the top, and once we fill them with water, they're very heavy, about 5 tons each. The curve actually improves the strength, but it's the strength I'm worried about."
"Why?" Stern said.
"Come closer."
Gordon ran his fingers over the surface of the glass.
See these little pits? These little grayish spots? They're small, so you'd never notice them unless you looked carefully. But they're flaws that weren't there before. I think the explosion blew tiny drops of hydrofluoric acid into the other room. And now the glass has been etched. Yes, slightly. But if these pits have weakened the glass, then the shields may crack when they are filled with water, and the glass is put under pressure. Or worse, the entire glass shield may shatter. And if it does? Then we won't have full shielding around the site, Gordon said, looking directly at Stern. In which case, we can't safely bring your friends back. They'd risk too many transcription errors.
Stern frowned. Do you have a way to test the panels? See if they'll hold up?
Not really, no. We could stress test one if we were willing to risk breaking it. But since we have no spare panels, I wouldn't do that. Instead, I'm doing a microscopic polarization visual inspect.
He pointed to the technician in the corner wearing the goggles going over the glass.
That test can pick up pre-existing stress lines, which always exist in glass, and give us a rough idea of whether they'll break. Andy's got a digital camera that is feeding the data points directly into the computer.
You going to do a computer simulation? Stern said.
It'll be very crude, Gordon said. Probably not worth doing, it's so crude. But I'll do it anyway.
So what's the decision?
When to fill the panels.
I don't understand.
If we fill them now and they hold up, then everything is probably fine. But you can't be sure. Because one of the tanks may have a weakness that will break only after a period of pressure. So that's an argument to fill all the tanks at the last minute.
How fast can you fill them?
Pretty fast. We have a fire hose down here. But to minimize stress, you probably want to fill them slowly. In which case, it would take almost 2 hours to fill all 9 shields.
But don't you get field bucks starting 2 hours before?
Yes, if the control room is working right. But the control room equipment has been shut down for 10 hours. Acid fumes have gotten up there. It may have affected the electronics. We don't know if it is working properly or not.
I understand now, Stern said. And each of the tanks is different.
Right. Each one is different.
It was, Stern thought, a classic real-world scientific problem. Weighing risks, weighing uncertainties. Most people never understood that the majority of scientific problems took this form. Acid rain, global warming, environmental cleanup, cancer risks. These complex questions were always a balancing act, a judgment call. How good was the research data? How trustworthy were the scientists who had done the work? How reliable was the computer simulation? How significant were the future projections? These questions arose again and again. Certainly the media never bothered with the complexities since they made bad headlines. As a result, people thought science was cut and dried in a way that it never was. Even the most established concepts, like the idea that germs cause disease, were not as thoroughly proven as people believed. And in this particular instance, a case directly involving the safety of his friends, Stern was faced with layers of uncertainty. It was uncertain whether the tanks were safe. It was uncertain whether the control room would give adequate warning. It was uncertain whether they should fill the tanks slowly now or quickly later. They were going to have to make a judgment call, and lives depended on that call. Gordon was staring at him, waiting. Are any of the tanks unpitted? Stern said.
Yes, 4.
Then let's fill those tanks now, Stern said, and wait for the polarization analysis and the computer sim before filling the others.
Gordon nodded slowly. Exactly what I think, he said.
Stern said, what's your best guess? Are the other tanks okay or not?
My best guess, Gordon said, is that they are. But we'll know more in a couple of hours.
Six hours, 40 minutes, 22 seconds.
Good Sir Andre, I pray you come this way,
Guy de Malagon said with a gracious bow and a wave of his hand. Merrick tried to conceal his astonishment. When he had galloped into Laroc, he fully expected that Guy and his men would kill him at once. Instead, they were treating him deferentially, almost as an honored guest. He was now deep in the castle, in the innermost court where he saw the great hall, already lit inside. Malagon led him past the great hall and into a peculiar stone structure to the right. This building had windows fitted not only with wooden shutters, but with window panes made of translucent pig bladders. There were candles in the windows, but they were outside the pig bladders instead of inside the room itself. He knew why even before he stepped into the building, which consisted of a single large room. Against the walls, gray fist-sized cloth sacks stood heaped high on raised wooden platforms above the floor. In one corner, iron shot was piled in dark pyramids. The room had a distinctive smell, a sharp, dry odor, and Merrick knew exactly where he was. The arsenal. Malagon said, "Well, Magister, we found one assistant to help you."
"I thank you for that."
In the center of the room, Professor Edward Johnston sat cross-legged on the floor. Two stone basins containing mixtures of powder were set to one side. He held a third basin between his knees, and with a stone mortar, he was grinding a gray powder with a steady circular motion. Johnston did not stop when he saw Merrick. He did not register surprise at all.
"Hello, Andre," he said.
"Hello, Professor."
"Still grinding. You all right?"
"Yes, I'm okay. Hurt my leg a little."
In fact, Merrick's leg was throbbing, but the wound was clean. The river had washed it thoroughly, and he expected it to heal in a few days. The professor continued to grind, patiently, ceaselessly.
"That's good, Andre," he said in the same calm voice. "Where are the others?"
"I don't know about Chris," Merrick said. He was thinking of how Chris had been covered with blood. "But Kate is okay, and she is going to find the..."
"That's fine," the professor said quietly, his eyes flicking up to Sir Guy. Changing the subject, he nodded to the bowl. "You know what I'm doing, of course."
"Incorporating," Merrick said. "Is the stuff any good?"
"It's not bad, all things considered. It's willow charcoal, which is ideal. The sulfur is fairly pure, and the nitrate's what you'd expect."
"Guano."
"That's right."
"So it's about what you'd expect," Merrick said.
One of the first things Merrick had studied was the technology of gunpowder, a substance that first became widely employed in Europe in the 14th century. Gunpowder was one of those inventions, like the mill wheel or the automobile, that could not be identified with any particular person or place. The original recipe, one part charcoal, one part sulfur, six parts saltpeter, had come from China. But the details of how it had arrived in Europe were in dispute, as were the earliest uses of gunpowder, when it was employed less as an explosive than as an incendiary. Gunpowder was originally used in weapons when firearms meant arms that make use of fire, and not the modern meaning of explosive projectile devices such as rifles and cannon. This was because the earliest gunpowders were not very explosive, because chemistry of the powder was not understood, and because the art hadn't been developed yet. Gunpowder exploded when charcoal and sulfur burned extremely rapidly, the combustion enabled by a rich source of oxygen, namely nitrate salts, later called saltpeter. The most common source of nitrates were bat droppings from caves. In the early years, this guano was not refined at all, simply added to the mixture. But the great discovery of the 14th century was that gunpowder exploded better when it was ground extremely finely. This process was called incorporation, and if properly done, it yielded gunpowder with the consistency of talcum powder. What happened during the endless hours of grinding was that small particles of saltpeter and sulfur were forced into microscopic pores in the charcoal. That was why certain woods, like willow, were preferred. Their charcoal was more porous.
Merrick said, "I don't see a sieve. Are you going to corn it?"
"No," Johnston smiled. "Corning's not discovered yet, remember?" Corning was the process of adding water to the gunpowder mixture, making a paste that was then dried. Corn powder was much more powerful than dry mixed powder. Chemically, what happened was that the water partially dissolved the saltpeter, allowing it to coat the inside of the charcoal micropores, and in the process, it carried the insoluble sulfur particles inside too. The resulting powder was not only more powerful, but also more stable and long-lasting. But Johnston was right. Corning was only discovered around 1400, roughly 40 years from now. "Should I take over?" Merrick said. Incorporating was a lengthy process. Sometimes the grinding went on for 6 or 8 hours. "No, I'm finished now." The professor got to his feet, then said to Sir Guy, "Tell my Lord Oliver that we are ready for his demonstration."
"Of Greek fire?"
"Not precisely," Johnston said. In the late afternoon sun, Lord Oliver paced impatiently along the massive wall of the outer perimeter. The battlement was more than 15 feet wide here, dwarfing the row of cannon nearby. Sir Guy was with him, as well as a sullen Robert de Kerr. They all looked up expectantly when they saw the professor.
"Well, are you at last prepared, Magister?"
"My lord, I am," the professor said, walking with two of his bowls, one under each arm. Merrick carried a third bowl in which the fine gray powder had been mixed with a thick oil that smelled strongly of resin. Johnston had told him not to touch this mixture on any account, and he needed no reminding. It was a disagreeable, reeking goo. He also carried a bowl of sand.
"Greek fire? Is it Greek fire?"
"No, my lord, better. The fire of Athenaeus of Necrotis, which is called automatic fire."
"Is that so?"
Lord Oliver said. His eyes narrowed.
"Show me."
Beyond the cannon was the broad eastern plain where the trebuchets were being assembled in a line. They were just out of shot range, 200 yards away. Johnston set his bowls on the ground between the first two cannon. The first cannon he loaded with a sack from the armory. He then placed a thick metal arrow with metal vanes into the cannon. "This is your powder and your arrow." Turning to the second cannon, he carefully poured his finely ground gunpowder into a sack, which he stuffed into the cannon mouth. Then he said, "André, the sand, please." Merrick came forward and set the basin of sand at the professor's feet.
"What is this sand for?" Oliver asked.
"A precaution, my lord, against error." Johnston picked up a second metal arrow, handing it gingerly, holding it only at each end, and gently inserting it into the cannon. The tip of the arrow was grooved, the grooves filled with thick, brown, acrid paste. "This is my powder and my arrow." The gunner handed the professor a thin stick of wood, glowing red at one end. Johnston touched the first cannon. There was a modest explosion, a puff of black smoke, and the arrow flew onto the field, landing 100 yards short of the nearest trebuchet. "Now my powder and my arrow." The professor touched the second cannon. There was a loud explosion and a blast of dense smoke. The arrow landed alongside a trebuchet, missing it by 10 feet. It lay in the grass. Oliver snorted.
"Is that all? You will forgive me if I have..."
Just then, the arrow burst into a circle of fire, spitting blobs of flame in all directions. The trebuchet immediately caught fire, and men on the field ran forward, carrying their horses' water bags to put it out.
"I see," Lord Oliver said.
But water seemed to spread the fire, not quench it. With each new dousing, the flames leapt higher. The men stepped back, confused. In the end, they watched helplessly as the trebuchet burned before them. In a few moments, it was a mass of charred, smoking timbers.
"By God, Edward and St. George," Oliver said.
Johnston gave a small bow, smiled.
"You have twice the range and an arrow that alights itself. How?"
"The powder is ground fine and so explodes more fiercely. The arrows are filled with oil, sulfur, and quicklime, mixed with tow. Touching any water makes them catch fire. Here, it's the dampness of the grass. That is why I have a basin of sand. Should the slightest bit of the mixture be upon my fingers and start to burn from the moisture of my hands. It is a most delicate weapon, my lord, and delicate to handle. He turned to the third basin near Merrick. Now, my lord, Johnston said, picking up a wooden stick, I pray you observe what follows. He dipped the stick into the third bowl, coating the tip with the oily, foul-smelling mixture. He held the stick in the air. As you see, there is no change, and there shall be no change for hours or days until... With the theatricality of a magician, he splashed the stick with a small cup of water. The stick made a hissing sound, began to smoke, and then burst into flames as the professor held it. The flame was a hot orange color.
Ah, Oliver said, sighing with pleasure. I must have a quantity of this. How many men do you require to grind and make your substance?
My lord, 20 will do, 50 is better.
You shall have 50 or more, as you will, Oliver said, rubbing his hands. How quickly can you make it?
The preparation is not lengthy, my lord, Johnston said, but it cannot be done in haste, for it is dangerous work. And once made, the substance is a hazard within your castle, for Arnaud is certain to attack you with flaming devices tonight. Oliver snorted.
I care nothing for that, Magister. Make it now, and I shall put it to use this very night.
Back in the arsenal, Merrick watched as Johnston arranged the soldiers in rows of 10, with a grinding bowl in front of each man. Johnston walked down the rows, pausing now and again to give instructions. The soldiers were grumbling about what they called kitchen work, but Johnston said to them that these were, in his words, the herbs of war. It was several minutes later when the professor came over to sit in the corner with him. Watching the soldier work, Merrick said,
Did Donega give you that speech about how we can't change history?
Yes, why?
It seems like we're giving Oliver a lot of help to defend his castle against Arnaud. Those arrows are going to force Arnaud to push his siege engines back, too far back to be effective. No siege engines, no assault on the fortress, and Arnaud won't play a waiting game. His men want quick scores, all the free companies do. If they can't take a castle right away, they move on.
Yes, that's true.
But according to history, this castle falls to Arnaud.
Yes, Johnston said, but not because of a siege, because a traitor lets Arnaud's men in.
I've been thinking about that too, Merrick said. It doesn't make sense. There are too many gates in this castle to open. How could a traitor possibly do it? I don't think he could.
Johnston smiled. You think we might be helping Oliver keep his castle and so we're changing history?
Well, I'm just wondering.
Merrick was thinking that whether or not a castle fell was actually a very significant event in terms of the future. The history of the Hundred Years' War could be seen as a series of key sieges and captures. For instance, a few years from now, brigands would capture the town of Moins at the mouth of the Seine, in itself a minor conquest. But it would give them control of the Seine, allowing them to capture castles all the way back to Paris itself. Then there was the matter of who lived and who died, because more often than not, when a castle fell, its inhabitants were massacred. There were several hundred people inside La Roque. If they all survived, their thousands of descendants could easily make a different future.
We may never know, Johnston said. How many hours have we got left?
Merrick looked at his bracelet. The counter said 5 hours, 50 minutes, 29 seconds. He bit his lip. He had forgotten that the clock was ticking. When he had last looked, there were almost 9 hours. There had seemed to be plenty of time. 6 hours didn't sound quite so good.
Not quite 6 hours, Merrick said.
And Kate has the marker?
Yes.
And where is she?
She went to find the passage.
Merrick was thinking that it was now late afternoon. If she found the passage, she could easily make her way inside the castle in 2 or 3 hours.
Where did she go to find the passage?
The Green Chapel.
Johnston sighed. Is that where Marcel's key said that it was?
Yes.
And she went alone?
Yes.
Johnston shook his head.
No one goes there. Why? Supposedly, the Green Chapel is guarded by an insane knight. They say his true love died there and that he lost his mind with grief. He's imprisoned his wife's sister in a nearby castle, and now he kills anybody who comes near the castle or the chapel.
Do you think that's all true? Merrick said.
Johnston shrugged. No one knows, he said, because no one has ever come back alive.
5 hours, 49 minutes, 55 seconds. Her eyes squeezed tightly shut, Kate waited for the axe to fall. The knight above her was snorting and grunting, his breath coming faster, more and more excited before he delivered the killing blow. Then he was silent. She felt the foot in the middle of her back twist. He was looking around. The axe thunked down on the block inches from her face, but he was resting it, leaning on it while he looked at something behind him. He started grunting again, and now he sounded angry. Kate tried to see what he was looking at, but the flat blade of the axe blocked her view. She heard footsteps behind her. There was someone else here. The axe was raised again, but now the foot came off her back. Hastily, she rolled off the block and turned to see Chris standing a few yards away, holding the sword that she had dropped.
Chris! Chris smiled through clenched teeth. She could see he was terrified. He kept his eyes on the Green Knight. With a growl, the knight spun, his axe hissing as he swung it. Chris held up his sword to parry. Sparks flew from clanging metal. The men circled each other. The knight swung again, and Chris ducked, stumbled backward, and got hastily to his feet again as the axe thunked into the grass. Kate fumbled in her pouch and found the gas cylinder. This foreign object from another time seemed absurdly small and light now, but it was all they had.
Chris!
Standing behind the Green Knight, she held up the cylinder so he could see it. He nodded vaguely, continuing to dodge and back away. She saw he was tiring fast, losing ground, the Green Knight advancing on him. Kate had no choice. She ran forward, leapt into the air, and landed on the Green Knight's back. He grunted in surprise at the weight. She clung to him, brought the canister around to the front of his helmet, and fired gas through the slit. The knight coughed and shivered. She squeezed again, and the knight began to stagger. She dropped back to the ground. She said,
"Do it."
Chris was on one knee, gasping. The Green Knight was still on his feet, but weaving. Chris came slowly forward and stabbed the sword into the knight's side between the armor plates. He gave a roar of fury and fell onto his back. Chris was on him immediately, cutting the laces of his helmet, kicking it away with his foot. She glimpsed tangled hair, matted beard, and wild eyes as he swung the sword down and severed the knight's head. It didn't work. The blade came down, crunched into bone, and stuck there, only part way through his neck. The knight was still alive, looking at Chris in fury, his mouth moving. Chris tried to pull the sword out, but it was caught in the knight's throat. As he struggled, the knight's left hand came up and grabbed his shoulder. The knight was immensely strong, demonically strong, and pulled him down until his face was inches away. His eyes were bloodshot, his teeth were cracked and rotten. Lice crawled in his beard among bits of discolored food. He stank of decay. Chris was revolted. He felt his hot, reeking breath. Struggling, he managed to put his foot on the knight's face, and he stood up, forcing himself free of the grip. The sword came free in the same moment, and he lifted it to swing down. But the knight's eyes rolled upward and his jaw went slack. He was already dead. Flies began to buzz over his face. Chris collapsed, sitting on the wet ground trying to catch his breath. Revulsion swept over him like a wave, and he started to shiver uncontrollably. He hugged himself, trying to stop it. His teeth were chattering. Kate put her hand on his shoulder. She said, "My hero." He hardly heard her. He didn't say anything. But eventually he stopped shivering and got to his feet again. "I was glad to see you," she said. He nodded and smiled. "I took the easy way down." Chris had managed to stop his slide in the mud. He had spent many difficult minutes working his way back up the slope, and then he took the other path down. It turned out to be an easy walk to the base of the waterfall where he found Kate about to be beheaded. "You know the rest," he said.